Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 44. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your encouragement and generosity. You can find a full list of patrons on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. You'll also be given access to a number of patron-only episodes. August's prize is a gift voucher for Claire Ridgway's wonderful The Life of Anne Boleyn online course, valued at $75. There's no start or end date, so it can be done at your own pace from the comfort of your own home. A huge thank you to Claire for donating this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about 16th century Languedoc is Professor Susanna Lipscomb. Professor Lipscomb is an award-winning historian, author, and broadcaster. She's Professor of History at the University of Roehampton, a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and holds a Master of Arts, Master of Studies, and a Doctor of Philosophy in History from Lincoln and Balliol Colleges, Oxford. She has written 5 books and presented 13 history TV series. My conversation with Susanna straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, Susanna. How are you?
I'm very well. Delighted to be here.
It's lovely to have you back on the show. And it's been actually almost a year since you were last on the show. That's gone very quickly.
Well, and Talking Tudors has come on great guns since then. It's a wonderful podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, since the last time you were on, we've had actually lots of new listeners join us. So would you mind just introducing yourself again and just sharing a little bit about your background?
Okay, well, I'm a historian. I'm a professor of history at the University of Roehampton, and I work on the 16th century. So I've written a few books about Henry VIII, one called 1536, The Year That Changed Henry VIII, which was exploring my idea that actually there was a radical change in Henry's personality from the sort of gorgeous young prince to becoming the ruthless, obese tyrant, and that it clusters around the year 1536. I also wrote one about his last will and testament, which sounds rather dry, but actually it's an exciting story of the last days of his life. It's called The King is Dead. And it's looking at that last year of his life and the idea whether there was a conspiracy theory to change his will or not. I've written a guide to Tudor places in the UK, specifically England, Tudor England, Visitor's Companion to Tudor England, and also a little book about witchcraft for a ladybird expert, which was looking at the persecution of people as witches, chiefly women, between about 1550 and about 1750 in Europe. And I also do a bit of broadcast work and as well as teaching my students. So, I mean, I'm a very lucky person.
Wonderful, thank you. Now, last time we spoke, we chatted about Henry VIII and his queen consorts. That was back in episode 7, if anyone wants to have a listen, I recommend it. Today, however, I'm excited to speak with you about your latest book, The Voices of Neem, Women, Sex and Marriage in Reformation Languedoc. So what is this book about and how did the idea for it come about?
So in this book, I've leapt across the channel and I'm a few decades later, more parallel to Elizabeth I's reign than Henry VIII. And it's looking at a much lower level of society. So it's looking at people who were, you know, butchers and bakers, candlestick makers, and their wives chiefly. So it's looking at the women of ordinary society, basically you and me in the past. I did work on this originally for my doctorate, for my PhD. And it came about because I got interested in the fact that in the 16th century, this was a period of religious violence in France as a result of the Reformation between Catholics and Protestants. And one of the reasons or catalysts for violence occurring often seemed to be to do with women. So women were attacked in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre of 1572. Specifically, pregnant women were attacked. There's a kind of theme. And so I started to be interested in women and religion. And then I came on this offshoot was discovering that where people converted to Protestantism in France, the local not quite elite, but the people of some status in the town who had become Protestants set up these consistories, which are kind of governing bodies of the local church, but also a form of morals court. And at the time, it is very much thought that if you want to control morals, you need to control women. So the records of this consistory, which not many people had looked at by that point, are really full of information about ordinary women. And for most women in the 16th century, who aren't Elizabeth I, we don't have many records about them. We don't, you know, or Aunt Anne Boleyn. Most of them, you know, couldn't read or write. Only 5% of women could read or write by the end of the 16th century in England. So they're not keeping letters or diaries. We don't have any of that kind of eager literature which would let us into their lives. Generally speaking, they don't have much status before the law. If they're poor, they don't really have anything to leave. So they're not leaving, you know, elaborate wills and testimonies we can get to know about. So, you know, they just don't make any impression on the record of history. So the fact that we had this set of documents, this kind of court, it's not really a court, but this kind of court that is providing information about ordinary women's lives was just too tantalizing to not to read them and write about them.
Absolutely. Now, before we delve even deeper, I imagine that a lot of our listeners are quite familiar with what's happening in England at this time. Could you just sort of set the scene a little bit more and help us understand the historical context? So what was going on in 16th century Languedoc?
Okay, so Languedoc at this point is part of France. Traditionally speaking, or centuries before, it hadn't been part of France, but as a result of the Cathar heresy, people might distantly remember that in the 13th century, it had become part of the Kingdom of France. But there's your first clue. This is an area that has a tradition of disagreeing with the authorities in the central front and having different views in religious terms. So at this point in time, in the 1550s, people had been converting to Protestantism of the John Calvin variety. So after Luther's protest 1519, nailing those theses to the door in Wittenberg, over time Protestantism has various different leaders, proponents. John Calvin is one of them. In 1536, funnily enough, he writes his Institutes of the Christian Religion, or publishes it, which is his first statement of doctrine. And over in various different places in Europe, people start to convert to Calvinism. So Scotland, for example, quite Calvinist. And this is the particular brand of Protestantism that spreads in France, but it's illegal. So in the 1550s, people are still being persecuted for believing this. But there's a sort of groundswell of people converting, particularly in a kind of crescent shape across the south of France and up to La Rochelle in the west. And eventually in 1559, the Protestant church in France is formally established, and as a result of the number of people converting, there is, and this is a long history here, I'm making very short, but there is a decision in the early 1560s to make Protestantism legal in France. This toleration of Protestantism is, however, very, very politically charged. And as a result, over the subsequent years, from 1562 onwards, for at least the next 40 years, it's a period of religious warfare, led by those Catholics who believe that Protestants, you know, are the Antichrist, and fought by those Protestants who believe that Catholics are the Antichrist. And this is, at one level, happening in the court and high nobility, and there's a sort of story there about battles and power, but it's also happening at a very local level where, you know, you have neighbours attacking their erstwhile neighbours because they believe different things to them. And so there are certain places where Protestants get a foothold, and create strongholds. And Nîmes, which is a city in the south of France, not far from the port of Marseille, or you might have heard of Avignon, it's 30 miles from Avignon, that becomes one of the cities that stays strongly Protestant. And it's a Protestant city surrounded by a sea of Catholic believers. And there are times when being a Protestant puts you in fear of your life. If you leave the town of Nîmes, about three quarters of the people in Nîmes become Protestant. At certain times when there are royal armies ravaging around, you're going to be killed if you stand up for your beliefs. So it's a fraught time. And one of the things that these cities that become Protestant do to try and defend themselves from the wrath of God is that they consider that if they adhere to a really strict moral code, God will look on them favourably. And so that's where the sources come from.
You mentioned the consistory courts. I want to delve into that a little bit more. So I've read that the work is based on evidence of 1,200 cases. Is that right?
Yes. So there are 1,200 cases that I've drawn on for this book. I read a lot more, but those are the ones that are the body of the book. It was a lot.
That's a lot of cases to be reading. So, and that was predominantly, I believe, between the period 1560 and 1615. So, could you tell us a little bit more about this court? So, what was its role, and what sorts of cases did it hear?
Okay, so it's not a legal court; it's a religious tribunal, I suppose. Although a lot of the men who are leading it like to think of themselves as having some sort of legal power, and many of them have a background in law as well. So it apes a legal court a lot. Now, it is established in each church. So the way that the Protestant church in France, indeed in Scotland as well, run is through a Presbyterian system, which is to say they don't have bishops and a series of hierarchy. What they have is local lay people, not members of the clergy, who are appointed as elders and deacons to run the local church. And they have the authority to punish people in the church who haven't done what they should do. So this is a book all about people doing things they shouldn't do. So they established this, and it has some positive purposes, like to dole out poor relief to those who need it and to run the church. They make decisions like whether the windows in the church should be opened on a hot day and whether they should move the service to 5 a.m. because it gets very hot in the south of France in the summer, things like that. But what they chiefly do is they spend a lot of time gathering reports about people who have been immoral. And each of the elders is given a few streets to police. So, I mean, they literally walk up and down looking for people doing things they shouldn't do. Sometimes this involves them spying on people in the early hours of the morning or the dead of night. They also gather reports from other people. One of the things that the consistory does is it generates a kind of culture of voyeurism and prurience and, you know, tittle-tattle. So if you've heard that your neighbour has come back and seems to be wearing she seems to be wearing new clothes, and you know she doesn't earn enough money to have new clothes, so maybe she's got the money from a man, you know, that sort of thing. That sort of rumour gets passed on to the consistory as well, and they investigate that as well. So it's gossip central. And as a result of people's gossip and spying and this kind of malicious culture, whoever is in the wrong gets hauled up before them and interrogated.
Did they investigate both cases against men and women? Or is it just
they do investigate cases against men and women, which is unusual at the time. This is a deeply patriarchal society, and generally speaking, it's assumed that sexual sin is a woman's responsibility. And if we compare it to some other records that I looked at from the criminal cases against people for immorality, because this is a time that even the law is interested in sexual immorality. So in French at the time, it has this delicious word. It's called paillardise, which pie is hay. So paillardise is almost literally rolling in the hay.
That's
sex before marriage. And if you, so there are in, say, the parallel city of Montauban, which is also a Protestant city, we have cases where people, women are being evicted from the town for 3 years or who are being punished in various ways for paillardise. But so the and the men aren't punished, even though they're mentioned. By contrast, in the consistory, the men are interrogated, but they still, the emphasis still falls on women. That, you know, that cultural bias still means that they spend more time asking questions of women than they do of men.
Okay, and so you've already said that they're there to sort of control women and their behaviour and investigate that. So how is it that they inadvertently empowered the women? I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, in all sorts of ways, really. I mean, this was, it feels like it's an unfortunate thing to say, but there's certainly an extent to which much of the gossip that's going on about how people are behaving is being passed around by local women. So without meaning to, they're already valorising women's chatter about events in the town. So that gives women a role in kind of defining the moral boundaries of the town and saying what's permissible and what's not, because what they're saying is listened to by these elders and then brought up in the consistory. But also, because they provide a forum in which women can speak, they also empower them. And what's interesting about the consistory is that it's that people can approach it as well with their own cases. So women who have been jilted, for example, can say, you know, that man promised to marry me and now he's reneging on his promise. And the consistory take this very seriously. They care a lot about the proper formation of marriage. Engagement vows are as binding as marriage vows, although nevertheless, in a sort of logical inconsistency, you aren't allowed to have sex between engagement and marriage. But if a man has promised to marry a woman and it can be proved that he promise that in all the right and proper ways and then is reneging on it, the consistory will make him marry her. So a woman can go along to the consistory and go, look, I've got all this proof and I have all these witnesses, theoretically can make that happen. So she's using the consistory to her own ends. Or a woman who has found her husband committing adultery, or in the sort of most radical cases, women who have been abused at home, though they tend to be less successful in getting justice from the consistory, or servant girls who have been sexually abused by their employers can turn up before the consistory and say, he raped me, basically, he tried to have sex with me. And so there's this kind of way in which inadvertently the consistory provides a mechanism for society being turned on its head and women using their words against powerful men in the town.
So the cases, they were taken seriously, they were investigated seriously, even the ones brought by women?
The only ones that aren't investigated seriously, generally speaking, tend to be the ones involving domestic violence, because at the time it's considered that it's a man's right to beat his wife. The only time when they get investigated seriously is if the violence is totally excessive, so she becomes, you know, bloody, or sorry, this is all quite unpleasant content, you know, is knocked unconscious or conscious, or if she's if it happens every day, or if it happens when he's drunk, because it's supposed to be a sort of moderate form of discipline, and obviously you can't be temperate and moderate if you're drunk. But everything else, yes, it does get taken seriously. If a woman claims that she's engaged to a man and can produce any evidence to back it up, it gets taken as seriously as if a man would come along and say that too. So amazingly, women's words are written down and valorized by the consistory in a way that they aren't by pretty much any other criminal court at the time.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So can you make some, it might be generalizing a little bit, but what does the research tell us about women in general, I suppose, the lives of ordinary women at this time?
We're in a situation, these women were living in a time when all of the society was stacked against them. They don't have any right to official roles in the church or the law. They, you know, they don't have generally any great economic status. When a woman marries, her possessions become those of her husband, and you know, she can't do anything with them. And in fact, sort sort of marriage is considered to be the height of your, you know, of what you can achieve. But what this, these sources reveal, in addition to that picture which we've always known, is that despite all of these practical and theoretical limits on their power, women continue to act as if they do have power. They continue to try and pursue their schemes and their suits, and they do it deliberately with the consistory. But I don't think that this is something that the consistory is creating. I think it's something that the consistory sources are capturing for us, because it also shows us women going off to speak to legal authorities, or to, for example, the criminal courts, or to the notaries who write wills and draw up contracts. And we see them continually operating in a way to try, you know, the technical academic phrases, with agency, to try and change, to try and change the circumstances of their lives, whether it's going to see soothsayers who happen to be visiting the town to ask them to make a spell over their child who's ill, or whether it's trying to persuade a man to marry them, or indeed to say that they don't want to marry a man to whom they are actually engaged. We see this level of activism and quiet power from women in an age when we've always traditionally thought they had none.
Now, I think that you met some pretty colourful women during your research. Could you tell us about, you know, one or two of the women that you came across?
There are so many extraordinary women. So, I mean, colourful women. There is a woman who we only know as the widow of Mouret, who is overheard in a shop saying that men who cannot do it, but who nevertheless, you know, as in who cannot create, make children, but who nevertheless persist in having sex with their wives six or seven times a night, should be taken to the square in the center of the town and crucified with a stake up their bottom. And she doesn't use the word bottom. So we get some aspects of women's speech that's a little shocking. Who should we talk about? So, I mean, some of the cases we're looking at are quite sad. There's a case of a girl called Jeanne Gorside, who was a servant girl who was raped by her employer's father-in-law. And we know this because she went on to have a child and then arranges for the child to be baptized into the faith of its father, i.e. to be Protestant. She is Catholic. And because of arranging this baptism, asking the couple who take the child to be baptized to name her and the father, the whole story comes to the attention of the church and gets investigated. In fact, the father of the child, this rapist, Pierre Courtenay, is actually a known abuser and has done this many other times to other women. But what we see in the case of Jeanne Gorside is a desperate situation. A woman has been made pregnant by a relative of her employer, and therefore is going to lose her job. As a servant girl, you can't continue to be pregnant outside of marriage, which is, you know, considered totally immoral, and continue to have your position. And we know that she asks a surgeon for some medicine to bring on her menstruation, i.e. for an abortion. We know that she gets hold of some, although the surgeon denies giving it to her. We see her go to the house of her friend, Astrid Capelin, because we have Astrid's testimony, and she says that Jeanne had said to her that she was desperate. At first, she says she has an overburdened liver. She doesn't even tell her friend what's going on, but she's probably 6 or 7 months pregnant by this time, and Astrid can see that she's pregnant and says, come on, you know, you can't tell me that you're not pregnant, at which point Jeanne says that she is and tells her the whole story and says that she is so desperate that she is carrying a knife close to her heart by which she plans to kill herself and the child that she has within her. So we get an insight into the depths of desperation that these awful circumstances, probably relatively common circumstances, could produce for women. But also, we see that after she's had the child, she doesn't just let sleeping dogs lie. She does something to bring an element of justice into the situation, to have the father named in a public context, to have the church investigate this injustice, this immoral act against her, and hopefully to produce some money that will pay for her and the child's upkeep. So we have the turning of the tables here, even in this desperate situation.
So that sort of idea that we have that women were, it was obviously a patriarchal society, as you've said, but this idea that we have that women were completely submissive and had no control over their lives, that kind of sounding like a bit of a myth from what I'm hearing.
Yes, so we've got two really stark things. On one hand, we have a situation where, as you say, patriarchy is very much in the ascendant. This woman has gone through, she has been raped in her occupation, in her job as a servant girl. There was nothing that she could do to stop that. And this, as I say, is probably quite common. It's impossible to generate statistics, but we know that women went into service, generally speaking, around the age of 13 and could serve for 10, 15 years whilst trying to build up enough capital to act as a dowry for marriage. So it's there's a culture of life cycle service where you've got teenage girls in households with much older men. And unfortunately, that often produces these situations of sexual predation. On the other hand, and much more positively, yes, the sense that women had no recourse, would completely be submissive, that they did not have any way to respond, does seem to suggest something that is a bit of a lie. And it's one of those situations where you think actually common sense should prevail here. Were women completely submissive? Is it any surprise that they weren't, really? Is it any surprise that women had a voice and that they took what power was available to them? Women have always been women. So actually we see that much of the situation and sort of view that we've had of men, male and female relationships in the 16th century has been just erroneous and based on a misunderstanding of how women would operate in those circumstances.
And do you think we can extrapolate a little bit just to touch on Tudor England just for a moment? Can we say anything about women, ordinary women in Tudor England? Or is that too much of a leap there, do you think?
It's not too much of a leap. There's nothing about the evidence I found of these women in 16th century France to suggest that it is specific to them being French, that is specific to them being in the south of France. You know, any time I see scraps of evidence, and the problem is that elsewhere there are scraps of evidence, but because we don't have this consistory type court operating in many places. Most places in Catholic France, for example, you've got the confessional, what people say goes into a private space and is not written down and is lost to the historian. So we don't have the evidence everywhere else, but there's nothing to suggest that these women are exceptional, which means that we can probably imagine that this is the culture that is operating elsewhere. We see evidence of this in Germany. What we have is for England suggests the same. So my supposition is that women, ordinary women in Tudor England, would have had the same sort of approach to their circumstances as these women in 16th century France.
And what can we learn? So like you and I or any other woman that's listening, what can we learn from these, you know, extraordinary women and, you know, these tragic cases, these other cases that you've studied? What can we take with us and maybe utilize in our lives today?
Well, if we wish, we can find a magical host of swear words that they use against each other. they have the most extraordinary language. These are not polite women of the 21st century. But more seriously, there is something about their resourcefulness and their resilience. These people are operating in circumstances that are quite often very, very difficult, but they dust themselves down and they get back up. And there's something there about their pursuit of justice and their hardiness and their sort of strength in circumstances that should have made them weak that we can probably learn quite a lot from them about.
Yeah, I really like that. Resourcefulness and hardiness. I'm storing it away in my mind to draw when I need. So Susanna, what's next for you? What are you doing? What are you working on now? Are you working on anything at the moment?
Well, what's next is back to episode 7 when I talked to you last time. So delayed by the fact that I've had a child.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. I am working on my version of Henry VIII's Queens. So I'm due to submit that in about a year's time. So I imagine that if I manage that, very challenging with an infant, but if I manage that it will be out in early 2021.
That is
so
really
that's quite
exciting.
Fun. It's really exciting to be writing about them and kind of bringing together all of the work that I've done on women in the 16th century and all the work I've done on Henry VIII and finally getting to concentrate on the women of his lives themselves. So.
Well, I can't wait to hear about that. And I hope you'll come back and talk to me again. We can make it a yearly thing that we chat.
Sounds great.
That'd be really great. Now, I think you probably remember from last time that the way we kind of end the episodes is to play our little game of 10 to go. So I'm pretty sure that I've got 10 different questions for you this time, I hope. So you ready to do that?
Yeah.
All right. What is a favorite or inspirational place close to you that you like to visit?
Obvious one is Hampton Court Palace. Oh. Is that too predictable? Should I go for something else?
No, you're so lucky to live close to that.
I am. I live less than half an hour away from it. So, you know, but let me say, here's another one. We have nearby, even closer to me, is the space that was Nonsuch Palace. So the palace is no more. There's an amazing model of it that one can go and see. But I can go and walk in a park that is the space that was Nonsuch Palace. So that's pretty inspirational as well.
I have to say, some people have probably heard me say this before. I've been in that park and just stood there for ages. And I think people thought, what is wrong with this lady? And I was there kind of trying to, like, come on, please, just, you know, imagine the palace. It's an amazing place. Really love it. Favorite comfort food?
Croissant.
Yum.
Nice coffee. In fact, let's paint the whole scenario. Let's be in a little cafe in Paris. Let's have a nice big cafe creme and a croissant. That just sounds amazing.
That sounds like comfort to me, definitely. Now, here's a new one that I've been I'm interested in. Do you believe in past life?
That's interesting. I have no experience of that, so it's not something I've come across. It's funny because when you meet your child and they seem to have the sort of wisdom of ages, it does make you wonder about how do you know everything? In fact, one of the leading French guide on child rearing, he's called Francois Dolto, says babies know everything. And you think, how? So I don't know. I don't think I believe in it. I don't think I do, but there's enough to stimulate my curiosity about those who think they do.
What was the last book that you bought?
Last book that I bought. I haven't bought many books recently because I am judging a book prize, which means I'm having huge numbers of books sent to me that I have to read in a really short space of time. So that's all. I'm not adding many more to them. I think the last one actually, though, I bought was The Cutout Girl, which was the biography prize winner from the year before. So this is the last one I got, which is Costa Book of the Year 2018. But as I say, most of the time at the moment I'm reading biographies and thinking about prize winners for the Costa Biography Award of 2019.
All right, fabulous. Now, I don't know if you're much of a television show watcher, but is there any series that you've binge watched?
I pretty much binge watched The Line of Duty, which I think is probably one that hasn't made it to you. It's a British series. That was the last one. I was just watching that a lot at about the time I gave birth. since then, there hasn't been quite so much time for binge watching. It's one about corrupt police officers and a unit that looks into them. It's a drama, The Line of Duty. So I recommend that.
Okay, I don't know. I don't think I've seen that here yet. You know what? I just discovered it and I was totally glued to I know I'm so late with this. It's embarrassing. Peaky Blinders. Oh my gosh, I could not stop. I started and I was like up to, you know, I normally go to bed at like 9:30. I was up till midnight. Have you seen Peaky Blinders?
I have not. That is another one I'm behind on. For some reason, there are some shows that I watch well after everybody else. True Detective was another one that I watched after everybody, but then also binge-watched. So, yeah, there are certain series that, you know, you get to catch up on, and Peaky Blinders is one of them.
You're going to have to. I really enjoyed it. I think you'll like it. Now, Susanna, what advice would you give your teenage self?
Don't date all those awful men in your
20s. Yep.
Seriously, also, it's okay not to know what you want to do. It's okay to let it all play out. It will come about in time. I think there was such a pressure on me and on teenagers today to know what it is that you want your career to be when I had no idea. I didn't even know when I finished my degree. And yet it has all fallen into place. And so just to take some of the pressure off a little bit, really, and just know that it's going to be okay.
What's something that you're currently looking forward to?
We have my child's christening this weekend. So actually this week I'm thinking about that a lot. So beyond that, holiday in Devon later in the month. It's funny enough, one of the things I've been looking forward to immensely, I just did 2 days ago, which was that I presented one of the proms at the Royal Albert Hall. So I was thinking that was on my horizon until very recently as the thing I was desperately looking forward to. So now mostly what I'm looking forward to is things that involve me just having fun, really. Holidays and those things.
That's brilliant. That sounds really good. Now, do you have a favourite colour?
Blue. I'm wearing it now.
Yes.
I never really ceased to wear it. Yes, blue.
Excellent.
That's not very specific. So I guess if I had to be very specific, I'd probably go with petrol blue.
And lucky last, what superpower would you like to have and why?
Oh, this isn't, I suppose the thing we dream about superheroes is that they can right injustice. And, you know, you hear about these tales of things happening to children across the world. So it would be some sort of, basically, I would like to become a sort of smiting angel, I suppose, to go and deal with those who do, or to step in order to stop the pain and injustice. But that's very serious and not very fun.
That's all right. No, we can be serious. That's okay. That's right. We definitely need it.
I believe that's why we get care so much about superheroes is that we long for the power to change things we don't think can be changed.
Yeah, that's so true. And Susanna, the very last thing that we do, as you probably remember, is our Tudor takeaway. Do you have another Tudor takeaway for us to have a look at after the episode?
So I would highly recommend to everybody who might not have had a chance to read it yet, Helen Castor's little book about Elizabeth I. So it's a Penguin Monarchs Series 1. It's a very short book. It's exquisitely well written. It really, in a very few words, pinpoints Elizabeth's character, and I just think it's a very, very good piece of work. I mean, there are lots of great biographies of Elizabeth. John Guy's recent one, for example, comes to mind, but Helen Castor's little book is just such a perfectly wrought piece of writing that really captures that queen. I would recommend people to go away and read that.
Excellent. Another fabulous book to add to our list. Susanna, it's been such a pleasure talking to you again. Thank you so much for making time to chat with me about your wonderful new book.
Thank you. Thank you, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.